This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, March 26, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. On the program today, John Carl Baker, the piece in the Jacobean magazine, Austerity in Heaven's Corridor, how Florida may be a model for the rest of the country. And I don't mean we're all going to be living in Disneyland. No, could be Austerity Land. Today at 10 a.m., Supreme Court started oral arguments on the health care reform, the Affordable Care Act. First up, question as to whether or not the Anti-Injunction Act applies. Do the parties have standing to complain about the mandate? We'll talk more about that as the program continues. Dick Cheney receives a new heart from an anonymous donor. I will repeat what I said on Twitter. I cannot think of anything worse than having my donated heart end up in Dick Cheney. We'll touch on that. Mitt Romney, his trouble with evangelicals continues, loses Louisiana. Don't know if it makes a big difference. And the New York Police Department protecting all of us by spying on such liberal organizations as housekeepers and nannies unions. Feel safer? Richer getting richer. You knew that, but more stats. Meanwhile, this story today in the Wall Street Journal, you all remember the Massey Energy's Big Branch mine disaster in Montcoal, West Virginia. 29 workers killed. A report out today by the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, which was tasked with doing a report on how the federal government handled investigating the mine and violations of safety, specifically the Mine Safety and Health Administration, measuring what kind of job they did, if they had done their job properly. This report by the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health found that better enforcement by government mine safety regulators could have mitigated and possibly prevented the 2010 disaster. Specifically, if MSHA had engaged in a timely enforcement of the Mine Act and applicable standards and regulations, it would have lessened the chances of and possibly could have prevented the UBB explosion. That's the Upper Big Branch explosion. Now, we're not going to be taking many more, maybe any more, calls from libertarians who want to just argue a broad defense of libertarian policies. But remember, think about this. Is the answer here to eliminate Mine Safety and Health Administration? Is it to shrink government and eliminate these regulations Or is it to strengthen them and to make sure that these administrations are executing the laws and the regulations that they're supposed to execute? We know this organization was larded up with right-wingers during the Bush administration, as called for by the Heritage Foundation. Get technocrats out of these regulatory bodies. Put loyalists in. We know that it was run by a former industry executive. Is the answer to get rid of regulation, in other words, shrink government, and just allow entities like Massey Coal, which has been bought out since then, but to allow these entities to self-police? Is there any reason to believe that in the absence of the Mine Safety and Health Administration, we would have had a better outcome? Or is there every reason to believe that it simply would have been worse and would have happened sooner? This is the central fallacy with this notion of we have a corrupt government, corporate forces are corrupting government, so the answer is to shrink government. It's absurd. It's absurd. And you could phrase this, you could frame this report as a failure of government. And you could frame it as this is why you can't have government regulation. Or you could look at it in a logical sense and realize we need more government regulation. We need better vetting of these regulatory bodies, as opposed to simply allowing, we can trust the coal mines themselves to take care of it. Because we all know, we all saw the huge drop-off in coal use as a function of these disasters. We know that if you live in West Virginia and you have absolutely no other economic opportunities, then you'll just say, I'm not going to work in the coal mines. Of course, that doesn't happen. Of course it doesn't. Not in the real world. So this is a perfect debunking to that notion that we should have less government. Of course. And just let the marketplace deal with this, because the marketplace would never deal with it. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more about privatization and the attack on the 99% with John Carl Baker, who has written this piece about Florida being the canary in the coal mine, if you will. We'll be right back after this. Hi, folks. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks. They've got more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature. They've got many audio versions of New York Times bestsellers. The one that I would go and download if I could get a free download from Audible.com, and you can actually at audiblepodcast.com/majority report right now, would be Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson's Winner Take All Politics: How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. I interviewed them on the show a while back. Unbelievably interesting book. audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Get a free downloadable Audible book now. are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. He's a writer for the Jacobin magazine. I always add an A at the end there. I'm not sure why. John Carl Baker, he is a doctoral student at the Cultural Studies, program at George Mason University. Are you there, John?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So let's talk about your piece in the Jacobin, Austerity in Heaven's Corridor. You write that as legislator-driven austerity measures proliferate around the country in the coming years, look no further than the Sunshine State's 2012 budget to get a sense of the nightmare that could be all of ours. Give us a rundown of these austerity measures that have taken place. Or rather, let's start with this. Give me a context in which these laws are passed in Florida. The Republican Party has had a stranglehold on Florida for some time.
Yeah, I mean, effectively, Florida is basically like a one-party state. There is a Democratic Party, but it's effectively a rump. And for 13 years, longer if you just count the legislature, but for 13 years, the Republicans have controlled the governorship as well as both of the houses, the Senate and the House of Representatives at the State House. And accordingly, they've been able to enact, particularly over the last 2 years, since Rick Scott got in, pretty much whatever they want. And what's interesting is that the local papers have grown so used to the Democratic Party's, you know, weakness and near non-existence that they'll actually report on, you know, sort of dissension within the Republican ranks as sort of evidence of, you know, actual moderation within the legislature. And one of the points I wanted to make in my piece was that this is really a sort of silly, almost laughable perspective, because even if, you know, a few things get shot down during a legislative session or in the budget, the vast majority of what's been put out, much of which is, you know, geared towards, you know, huge tax breaks for capitalists, corporations, and, you know, the widespread immiseration of everybody else, it gets passed with really no, you know, not much protest. And I thought it was worthwhile to draw attention to that. I didn't think there was much attention being paid to it. And so I wanted to set the scene a little bit with that sort of, I don't know, historical background there, because it's difficult to imagine, you know, 13 years of just total Republican rule in a particular state, even one that is, you know, fairly conservative like Florida.
Yeah, you mentioned you raised the national debate over the forced transvaginal ultrasound bills that have been sort of popping up around the country. And you basically say the game plan is to take out the most sort of infamous aspect of the bill, but leaving the core of the sort of the reactionary legislation behind. And you outline how that's happened multiple times in Florida. Run down for us some of the legislation that you think is the most egregious and most indicative of this of the problems there.
Well, I mean, just looking at the sort of the sheer numbers of what the budget, you know, encompasses this year, I think gives you some sense of just how bad it is. This year alone, there was $300 million cut from higher education, which, you know, that's the sort of figure you'll hear in the press. But that doesn't include, I should say, $487 million from financial aid for higher education, including some of Florida's, you know, major and very popular programs for parents. Tuition will be allowed to be hiked up by 15% at the state universities. This has actually occurred 4 years in a row. It will continue going up.
4 years in a row of each year it's been hiked by 15%?
Yeah.
Wow.
Technically, you know, it's one of those things where the legislature passes only sort of allows it. You know, it's in theory, the universities don't have to raise it that high, but inevitably they always do. It's to be expected that they will raise it by that much.
So you're talking about, on one hand, cuts from subsidizing the universities, on the other hand, a cut in financial aid. And then, I guess on the third hand, we're looking at price increases. So it is exponential, the amount of distance between someone being able to afford to go to college in Florida at a state university and then them and then actually going, I guess.
Well, yeah, it's getting worse. I mean, you know, the really sad thing is that, you know, at least if you look at the sort of like raw numbers, the tuition there doesn't seem that bad, even with the hikes. But what's really, like I said, sort of egregious is that the sheer number, and you have to understand, too, the cost of living is quite low, you know, compared to someplace like the Northeast, New York City, you say. But, you know, you have university presidents, including the presidents of University of Florida and Florida State, both of which are, you know, very popular, you know, nationally known universities, claiming that, you know, it's so low that we can just hike it up as much as we want. And in fact, included in the legislation and the budget this year, there's an opening for UF and FSU, given that they've met particular benchmarks, to raise their tuition beyond the 15%, and in fact, towards what they're calling, you know, a market rate of education. And so it may go up even further. And what came out in the news in Florida, sort of after my article was published, was that this may actually render Florida's prepaid program, college prepaid program, completely irrelevant, because it sort of established on the basis that you can, have a decent prediction year by year how much tuition will go up, and if it's, if tuition is basically just suddenly subject to the vagaries of the marketplace, that's not going to be possible. And so either the program itself is going to just sort of become redundant, or parents and students will have to make up the difference, you know, when they choose, if they choose to go or have the option to go to University of Florida or FSU.
I'm not familiar with that program. What is that prepaid program?
Well, it's something that parents establish when they, you know, they have children early on. It's basically like you pay a certain amount on a monthly basis or however you sort of choose. The state kind of holds on to the money, and in theory, it can be refunded to you if you choose not to use it. But the idea is that by the time your child graduates, you have, you know, enough tuition to cover. You have enough money in this sort of fund to cover tuition at any of the state's 11 universities.
And so let's move on to the cuts in state jobs as well.
Sure. Last year, there was $1 billion in pension cuts accomplished. It was accomplished through this sort of very underhanded 3% salary reduction for state employees, sort of making them pay into their pension. And that continued this year. So that's a, you know, fairly staggering kind of amount. And it was recently ruled unconstitutional. The state has already appealed it. And, you know, they certainly considered they would continue this year. So that will be going to court in the near future. But in terms of just raw job numbers, over 4,000 jobs were just slashed by the budget.
And your workers in Florida are subject to drug tests. Is that right?
Yeah, they'll now be subject to random drug testing. The sort of rationale behind that offered by people who promoted it, politicians, was that, you know, those are the sort of things that they're subject to if they were in the private sector. And so, you know, in the notion of some completely laughable concept of fairness, now they will be subject to random drug testing. And there's this sort of irrational fear of abusers, as if, you know, state workers are some sort of, you know, are just like running around addicted to drugs or something, and that they'll be able to stamp that out through this random testing. I mean, it's really a very egregious, you know.
Well, it's been a huge waste of money, hasn't it, in terms of food stamp recipients down there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's been proven to just be a complete waste of funds. It's, you know, and I think if anything, it's just part of a larger plan to basically kind of, you know, get rid of the public employment there. I mean, people that are publicly employed tend to have higher salaries than people in the private sector. And, you know, through this kind of like long-term process, you can see a sort of logic, you know, coming out of it, which is that, you know, in the future, workers should make, you know, very little money. They're going to have their wages slashed, and employment will be, you know, highly kind of dubious. You know, I think that the actual move towards increasing employment in Florida, which is something that the governor has, you know, quite explicitly claimed he's trying to do. I have, you know, some serious doubts about whether that's a kind of legitimate plan. In fact, I think, you know, establishing a sort of a new normal, fairly high unemployment rate is a fairly strategic move to, you know, it certainly has benefits for employers and businesses and capitalists, because it drives down wages. And I think, you know, the plan to sort of eliminate public workers and slash their wages, by the way, they haven't had a raise in 6 years either. It's really just a kind of, you know, form of this large scale move to just sort of eviscerate the public sector in Florida.
It would be nice to see that drug testing just for laughs, to see what happens if you drug test some of those state legislators. But I presume it's not in the bill.
Yeah, I know. I agree with you. Yes, that was explicitly not included. So we won't be able to tell, you know, who's a coked out legislator in Florida, of which I would imagine there are a few.
And they play some tricks also with the funding of primary and secondary education as well.
Yes, they did. Last year, there was a very controversial cut made, $1.35 billion, I believe. And it was, you know, a controversial move. It occurred at the same time that charter schools were sort of, you know, becoming more prominent in Florida in education. And there was a real fear, and a legitimate one, I think, that, you know, public education was sort of becoming a thing of the past in the state. So this year, with a whole lot of publicity, they added in $1.1 billion back to it, basically. And, you know, a lot of politicians were praising this. They did a big kind of song and dance, as if they suddenly saw the error of their ways and, you know, were standing behind public education in the state. But, you know, even papers, some of them reported, but many did not, you know, did kind of ignored the fact that if you combine them together, you still end up with a $250 million cut from public education in the state. And what's come out in the news over the past few weeks are some of the really, you know, just terrible results of that for local county school districts, many of whom are in the red by millions and millions of dollars. And they're, you know, desperately trying to find a way not to cut teaching staff. But, you know, ultimately, I think it may come down to that. Pasco County is $25.6 million in the red. Palm Beach, which is a fairly affluent county, is $33 million in the red.
This is a function of property values plummeting, right? And reassessments on property taxes?
Well, it's a combination of factors. I mean, at the one level, you have, you know, this kind of these state tax cuts occurring. And then, you know, and you also have this kind of like very widespread belief in, you know, I don't know, supply side economics or sort of Friedmanite thinking, you know, just a very sort of anti-tax attitude is kind of pervasive. But at the level of the county, of the counties, which previously could kind of rely on, you know, some level of property tax revenue to offset, you know, any sort of cuts at the state, they can no longer rely on that, because since 2007 with the housing crash, there's property taxes just have plummeted, and they're not a reliable source of revenue anymore. So you have this like almost a perfect storm of tax cuts, loss of revenue from property taxes, and just a kind of, you know, ideological belief in, I don't know, the free market, combining to result in these just like, you know, incredible deficits for public schools and for counties in Florida. Many of whom don't always have a say at the state level. I mean, they have politicians and representatives there, but sometimes they're, you know, doing their best to kind of navigate through the cuts that are coming down from the state while, you know, they're terrified of even considering the possibility of raising taxes.
There's been a tremendous amount of tax cutting that's gone on, theoretically to grow the economy by 700,000 jobs in Florida. Tell us how many, what the tax cuts look like, and how close Rick Scott is a couple years in to getting to that 700,000 jobs number.
Well, the tax cuts are sort of interesting because I think, you know, they give a decent indication of who's sort of immediately benefiting from them. There are things like, you know, the elimination of sales taxes on electricity used at a fruit packing house. The elimination of sales tax on repairs and parts for private planes. I mean, these are obviously geared towards the super rich. You know, everyday people do not stand much to benefit at all from the budget. And I think there's a lot, as my sort of article claims, they have a lot to lose, according to it. So that's one thing.
I mean, the idea is if you cut the taxes on the sales tax for repairing your plane, you'll start to get your plane repaired, as opposed to, I guess, before where you would just like not so worry if you hear like a clinking noise in the engine, right? You just keep flying. Is that the theory? Or, I mean, that seems to me one of the most useless tax cuts that one could ever argue to create new business. I mean, I think the whole thing is sort of a joke, but that one seems really extreme.
It's laughable. I mean, and the thing about Florida, and you know, it's truly disturbing what's going on there. I'm from Florida. I was born there. I was raised there. But, you know, on the other hand, there's a sort of side to it where you can look at it and it's this sort of raw object, you know, because in any other state, maybe not, I don't know, but there'd be some sort of ideological, you know, justification for things like eliminating the sales tax on repair and parts for small planes, you know, personal jets. But they're quite, you know, the state legislature and Rick Scott, they're quite honest about, you know, what they're doing. Like, no, we really just, you know, want to benefit the rich. We don't really care about the rest of you. You know, it's not like anybody's going to trade in their, you know, their bus pass for, you know, oh, well, now I can, you know, repair a small plane. I'll just buy that. I mean, it's a completely silly kind of statement, but it's one that they're quite honest, quite direct about, and it tells you a lot about where their priorities are.
How did it get this way? In other words, you know, what can we see from a historical standpoint? How does it develop to this point where there is no even argument that is need to be made for tax cuts for private jets and tax cuts for private jets that for an activity that would happen necessarily, you know, that there's no way that there's any elasticity about the idea of, you know, should I repair my jet or not? It's absurd. But how did it get to that point? Is it simply just because the Republican Party has dominated that the whole Overton window, the parameters of the conversation there have moved so far to the right that there is just no room for any type of pushback there?
Well, I think, you know, this is a discussion we should be having because, you know, I wrote this article for Jacobin Magazine, which is a fairly recent kind of useful left publication that very explicitly, you know, tries to make a leftist critique of liberalism. And I thought that this was a worthy topic because, you know, what's almost completely missing in the state of Florida and what makes it a sort of interesting object of study is the fact that the Democratic Party is totally absent, you know, or might as well be. And so, you know, when you ask for, you know, when you ask how we got here, you know, why isn't anyone sort of just proposing, well, why don't we, you know, create a state income tax, let's say, because, you know, Florida doesn't have one. You know, their absence is worth discussing, as is the actual policies that they promote there. I mean, one of the things that I've been struck by people like, you know, Judy Genshaft, who's the president of USF, you know, sort of a local spokesman, and she's sort of associated with the Democratic Party, as well as some of the people who have been protesting some of the cuts, is what they often say are things like, well, we don't deny that cuts have to occur, you know,
right.
Or, you know, we're realists, we understand that, you know, something has to happen, that we have to balance the budget. And I just think this is a completely incorrect way to go about, you know, opposing the right. I mean, they're basically giving in to their logic, which is that, you know, we have to completely destroy, you know, the public sector. And they basically, you know, they don't deny the cuts need to occur. If they really wanted to take a sort of proactive approach, they would formulate a far more kind of gutsy and substantive, antagonistic even set of policies, which they just don't do. I mean, right now they're sort of in Florida, the Democratic Party, you know, they advocate things like slight changes to the tax code, you know, enforcing taxes that are already there. I mean, it's very sort of just weak, you know, policies that I just think are, you know, they're not going to solve the problem ultimately anyway.
And we should say that this is, you know, this is not in a vacuum in the sense that there is plenty of support, I would imagine, for people who come out strongly in speaking against Rick Scott and his policies and offering alternative policies. Rick Scott is, I think, one of the most unpopular governors in the entire country. And that says a lot when you've got people who are actually, you know, guys like Scott Walker getting recalled. Rick Scott is not popular at all. And so there really is no justification for the Democratic Party, at least on political grounds, to be so weak.
Yeah, I mean, he's highly unpopular. I mean, it's amazing to me that the Democrats haven't just completely seized on that. He's hugely unpopular. The Republican leadership, I mean, has terrible press. They're obviously corrupt. Some of the most like odious characters are in the press day after day, you know, promoting tax cuts for themselves effectively. And you just don't see a lot of emphasis on that among the party. I should say that, you know, there are oppositional forces in Florida. I sort of gave them a shout out in my article. You know, Miami, Tampa, Tallahassee, Gainesville, and several other cities, Jacksonville, they all have, you know, Occupy groups. And, you know, those are all some of the biggest cities in Florida. And I suppose that's where you would expect, you know, the occupiers to have a presence. But, you know, they are taking a somewhat more proactive approach. And I think that many of the things that they advocate for and protest for are the sorts of things that, you know, you should expect from a reasonable opposition. But you don't see that at the sort of like full-on state level. And I think that's a completely, I don't know, it's an ultimately failing kind of proposition that needs to change. Because if not, you're just going to have a continued set of, you know, kind of free market, Friedmanite proposals that are going to pass and pass and pass. And even the sort of, you know, most kind of draconian ones that maybe we, you know, dodged the bullet from this time are going to pass, you know, in the next year and the following years and so forth. And you're just going to have this kind of like ongoing march towards privatization and towards the, you know, the immiseration of like the working class in Florida, everybody else, you know, the 99%, because truly the 1%, you know, the super rich are the ones that are benefiting from the budget and from legislation there.
And what of unions in that state? Are unions a potential for fighting back against these type of cuts? I mean, it would appear not.
No, that's a great question. I mean, because we already mentioned, you know, the cuts to students, and I think one of the things that I sort of argue is that, you know, what you see in places like Madison and also in the Occupy movements is, you know, you see on the one hand sort of unions protesting austerity measures or cuts to collective bargaining and things like that, or attempts to eliminate collective bargaining. But on the other hand, you see students, you know, protesting things like student debt in the Occupy movements. And those are the two groups that are adversely affected, as I said, like, you know, state workers and students. But as for unions, you know, a very small percentage of Florida's public workforce is unionized. Probably the most prominent union there is the Florida Education Association, who are constantly quoted in the media and so forth. But you know, this kind of permanent position as sort of like, you know, media mags. I mean, they don't have a right to strike, and so there's really not a whole lot of oomph behind much of what they say. So you know, you don't have a large unionized workforce. The unions that you do have are, you know, really not terribly radical or even very, I don't know, engaged with what's going on, taking a sort of proactive approach. They're sort of constantly on the defensive. And so the sort of end product of that is all of this constant move towards, you know, privatization, sort of marketization of everything, and the elimination of the public sector and of the public sphere in the state. And this is already a state which is overwhelmingly suburban. I mean, it doesn't have the sort of public space, public urban space that we see in New York City and some of the other Occupy movements or places. And so that's a part of it as well. It makes organizing there incredibly difficult. But for, you know, the powers that be, the sort of like capitalist class that benefits from these sorts of cuts, you know, it's a complete boon to them. And Florida is a kind of laboratory where they can enact this sort of like, you know, ultimate, you know, ultima thule of their sort of free market policy.
And this is why on this program, when we start to see the Democratic Party talk about things like families are tightening their belts, we need to do the same in government, it's this type of rhetoric and this type of framing that allows for these incredibly reactionary policies to be implemented. That's basically where it starts, is when you accept that frame of austerity, it's just a matter of time.
It's true. I mean, and I think this is something that, you know, we've seen coming for a long time, including at the national level. You know, this assumption that there's, say, like a crisis in Social Security that has to be fixed, or there's a crisis in Medicare and so forth. And then, of course, the sort of fix to the crisis ends up, you know, being some sort of privatization effort. And I think that's, you know, at the state level, you're seeing that replicated, perhaps in a more harmful, sort of pernicious form, where, you know, no one is really willing to say, or very few people, I should say, you know, are sort of willing to take a stand and just deny the whole idea of austerity, deny that cuts are inevitable. And you know, what you, so accordingly, what you end up seeing is just this, you know, constant increase in both political and economic power by state legislators and, you know, the sort of capitalist class in Florida.
John Carl Baker of the Jacobin Magazine, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break. Check out that Jacobin Magazine. I like what they're doing. Fairly new magazine. So new that I could barely pronounce it until I heard him say it. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, New York Police Department keeping us all safe from things like nannies, housekeepers. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. You made me untouchable for life. Yeah. And you wasn't the man. It hit me like a ton. So, late last week, the AP reports that new documents have come to light showing that the New York Police Department has been continuing on with programs and tactics that they developed supposedly for the state of emergency that we were nearly in, according to them, in the lead up and the aftermath to the Republican convention in 2004. In the old majority report, Janine and I invited onto the program, we had a couple cops come on at different times, friend of show, guys who were fairly rational individuals who would sit there and tell us, sort of off the record, and they believed it. They're like, there's going to be tremendous violence. They're coming in from everywhere. This is going to be WTO. This is going to be Seattle protest times three. And the police department was completely juiced up for this notion that they were about to face all out war. So everything was off. Everything was on the table. And I'm quite convinced that internally, somewhere along the chain of command, there is an understanding that we need to do this. We need to get our police force in a state of mind that they're under siege. To get them to do things, some guys you don't, obviously, but to get those reasonable cops to believe that there is such an incredible threat that they're willing to undermine the very liberties that they're supposedly protecting. You know, you saw this the other night out at this Union Station, Union Square. I want you to listen to this audio. There's nothing going on in Union Square, practically. The cops are starting to move in. There's video. We'll post the video on majority.fm. You can see a cop sort of out of the blue just start claiming that someone's throwing glass bottles. You don't hear any glass shattering. You don't see any bottles. The guy standing videotaping this is right near the cops. If there was anybody throwing bottles, you would have seen it. And you can hear the guy shooting the video going, "What are you talking about?" And the cop keeps yelling down the line to the other cops who are moving forward with this sort of fence, trying to get the cops scared and to react almost like to make them trigger happy. Listen to this audio. It really is incredible.
Watch the bottle! Watch the bottle! You guys throw bottles?
Oh,
back up!
God.
Back up now!
Are you
back up!
Serious?
Back up! Back up! Now!
Back up.
Throw a bottle, Sean.
Back up.
One of your guys threw a bottle. One of your undercover guys threw a bottle.
Back up.
One of your bosses hired an undercover to do a bottle.
Watch the bottles, guys. They want to hurt us. They want to hurt us, guys. Watch the
bottles.
They want to hurt us.
Oh, my God. They got plants. You got undercover throwing bottles.
Get off the stairs. Don't watch the bottles. They're throwing bottles at us. Glass bottles. They're throwing glass bottles at us, guys.
You're a liar, officer. You're a liar.
You hear that? They want to hurt us, guys. They're throwing glass bottles, guys. They're throwing glass bottles. There's no bottles. There's nothing being thrown. But this cop is trying to psych up the other cops. And so you have these tactics. You have these tactics that the police department and the intelligence units developed in 2004, which we didn't find out about until 2007, of course. In April 2008, apparently, well after the 2004 RNC, you math whizzes out there will know that it was 4 years after. An undercover New York Police Department went to New Orleans to attend the People's Summit, which was a gathering of liberal groups talking about U.S. economic policy and the effect of trade agreements, NAFTA, GATT, etc. When they summarized their reports, I guess, and I don't know why the NYPD is traveling, what the theory is why they're traveling down to New Orleans. You know, I know why you go to New Orleans. In the report, they singled out two activists, John Flaherty, who's a journalist, and then another one, Marissa Franco, who is literally a labor organizer for housekeepers and nannies. And they talk about a workshop that John Flaherty ran, who used to be in New York City. I mean, this just sounds like he's an editor and journalist of Left Turn magazine and was one of the main organizers of the conference. Flaherty held a discussion calling for the increase of divestment campaign of Israel and mentioned two events related to Palestine. Apparently, according to John Flaherty, all he did was intro a movie at a Florida film festival about Palestine. Supposedly, this is to fight terror. This is all done by a New York Police Department intelligence division, which we know has been headed by either former CIA operatives or concurrent CIA operatives. And we know, at the very least, that the New York Police Department has been engaging in spying on Muslims close up, unprovoked, sort of fishnet spying of Muslims, not just in New York, but throughout the Northeast. It's unbelievable. And yet, we hear nothing about this. The DHS puts out a report saying that there are right-wing paramilitary groups that we should be concerned about. The whole thing gets withdrawn because of right-wing pushback. Yet you have labor organizers and guys introducing films at film festivals winding up in reports in the New York Police Department, literally thousands of miles away. And if you think that's where it ends, you know, the police department says that for every traffic violation, they get like 42 by that same person go unticketed. I imagine there are similar odds in this instance in terms of New York Police Department spying. All right, folks, heading into the better half of the program today, wherein we'll talk about, James Murdoch. I wonder if he'll ever go back to Britain. Ever, ever, ever. Or if he's afraid of getting arrested. Dick Cheney's heart transplant. Mitt Romney. Evangelicals don't heart Mitt Romney. Thank you. And the rich.
Surprise, surprise.
Getting richer. All that, your phone calls, your IMs, and the better half of the program today. And folks, could use your membership. We got stories about Herman Cain putting out crazy-ass ads. Oh, let's stop the music for a second. You know, somebody sent me an email saying that those Breitbart guys, that Darbony and Lee Stranahan, have a blog talk radio show. I listened to like literally 30 seconds of it. The audio is just horrible. God knows what they're saying. And they are apparently funded by the Florida Americans for Prosperity Group. Now, as far as I know, neither one of these guys lives in Florida. I think they live in Texas. Do you understand the advantages you have as a right-wing anything in this country? I don't know how many people listen to that show. I find it very hard to believe that they're getting thousands of downloads a day, or that they have hundreds or thousands of people listening live. I find it hard to believe they have tens. I don't know how much money they're getting for the Americans for Prosperity. They've been quite upfront about getting that money. But we get no money from anybody but you. So we need your support. It's the only way that we can remain independent. It's the only way that we can remain, I don't even know that we could be dependent, even if there was an opportunity to be dependent. I don't think there's that opportunity for us. So it's the only way that we can continue the show is via your memberships. And if you've joined recently or donated or anything to that effect, much appreciated. Let's head to the better half of the program. Don't forget, there are other ways to support the program, but none are as valuable as your membership. And frankly, as encouraging. You can become a member today at majority.fm. You can also support the show by buying your coffee, tea, chocolate, fair trade, organic, just coffee. You can buy your Amazon junk through our Amazon link at majority.fm. Support the show. All you got to do this one time. Go, click on it, bookmark it, buy through there. You'll never know the difference. We'll be slightly happier. You can also give us a review on iTunes. That helps. Buy our merch. DonateYourAccount.com. See you in the better half.